And I'd like to talk a little bit about cloning, and particularly the cloning of a human being, and the types of questions that creates. You know that when you're flying to Israel, and you look down at Ireland from the sky, you can see Ireland as really a solid green. It's called the Emerald Island, which indeed it is. And that's also true with Scotland. Scotland is very, very green. And if you get a little closer, you will see on the hillsides hundreds, if not thousands, of sheep. Right? Scotland is full of sheep. It's very common that if you're driving on a highway, you may have to stop. Instead of a train crossing, there may be a sheep crossing. And sheep are known to be, you know, an indistinguishable herd. You talk about a herd of sheep or whatever it is. But lo and behold, among the many thousands of sheep in Scotland, there is one very, very unique little sheep, who by now is already a mother and grandmother. There is that although human beings are infinitely more complicated psychologically than cows and sheep, obviously, and we're more moral, but our bodies aren't that much more complicated than that of a sheep or any other complex mammal. And consequently, the science appears to be inevitable that if you can clone a sheep, you can clone a human being. And we also know that there's a truism in science that whatever can for fame, which are the true great, the two great motivators of society, unfortunately, is going to try to clone a human being. Now, obviously, there are two ways that one approaches, you know, new moral issues. One way of approaching it is, gee, we better devise some new moral code that will legitimate what we want to do. It's kind of working backwards. You decide what you want to do. It's like, you know, you draw the bullseye around the hole, you know. You decide what you want to do, and then you make a moral philosophy to justify it. Or the alternative approach, which is the religious approach, is to try to identify things that perhaps human beings should not do. And whether we could do it or not, basically human beings have to recognize that sometimes we say no. Now, before we get into the ethical dilemmas, it's very important that we understand exactly what do we mean by cloning of a mammal or cloning of a human being. What's the chiddush, so to speak? Like, what was the particular unique feature that cloning creates? And here, without getting into too much science, and indeed probably some of you know this much better than I do, but the basic bit of information to keep in mind is that every single cell of the body, every single cell, whether it be a cell from your fingernail or a cell from your hair or a cell from your liver or brain, contains the entire genetic blueprint of the entire organism. Meaning to say that the genes that are contained in any cell of your body contains the DNA for the brain, for the liver, for the hair, and the like. Now, when an egg initially, when a sperm initially fertilizes an egg, each one is contributing the chromosomal material, initially, when that egg begins to reproduce and split, there is not yet differentiation, meaning to say you don't yet have liver, brain, heart, etc. It just keeps on splitting, and the entire organism is there. What eventually happens in embryonic development is cell differentiation. Now, cell differentiation is the great mystery, really, of not just human growth, but of all organic growth. Because what happens is you have this mysterious on-off switch, that those cells that become liver cells, the DNA that is encoded for brain and for heart and for skin shuts off, and only the liver cells get, only the liver DNA genes get activated. Those cells that will become brain cells, everything else gets shut off. So there's a very mysterious on-off mechanism, as it were, which is called cell differentiation, in which, starting from a fertilized, from a zygote, from a fertilized egg, which contains all of the DNA, as the cell splits, when it gets beyond a certain number of splittings, a certain number of cells, there then begins the amazing process of differentiation. Well, what cloning does is, cloning, on some level, is a reversal of the differentiation and a reactivation of the DNA in areas that has already become cut off. So the way one would do it, I mean, there are a lot of different ways you can clone, really. But the way, let's say, Dolly was cloned was a cell was taken from her mammary gland, right, mammary gland, et cetera. An egg was taken. The nucleus of the DNA from the mammary gland was put into the nucleus of the egg. And through various processes, that DNA was reactivated so that from the mammary gland, the entire organism was able to be reproduced. And what happened, therefore, was the egg was fertilized, although fertilization would not be the appropriate word, but in the medium of the egg, it began to split. The egg was then transferred into a uterus of a sheep. And indeed, in 5 months later or 6 months later, whatever the gestation period of the sheep is, you had a genetic identical twin to Dolly. In other words, the chiddush of cloning, essentially, is the ability to take an already differentiated cell, by differentiated cell meaning a cell that is already a hair cell, or a liver cell, or a brain cell, or a fingernail cell, and reactivate the dormant genetic code, usually by putting it in an egg from which the nucleus has been stripped, and then there's this in vitro process which is then involved, is then transferred into a uterus. Again, people make a mistake. You sometimes think you could clone yourself and you'll have a copy of yourself, you know, 2 minutes later, like putting yourself in a Xerox machine. I mean, basically, what's going to happen is you will have an egg whose whole genetic contribution will come from one source. At least that's vanilla ice cream cloning. We'll talk about some other varieties later. And that egg then has to be transplanted into a uterus where it will be, it'll remain for a gestational period, but genetically it will be identical to you, right? So that's really, I'm sorry? No, no, it has to be the same sex as the source of the DNA. So you can... No, no, in other words, the DNA must be obtained from either a male or a female, okay? It is then placed in an egg from which the egg's own genetic material has been stripped away. The egg is simply the medium for the replication and the growth of the organism. So you can have a male clone or a female clone. And therefore, the unique thing about a clone is it the technology allows the reactivation of DNA that has already switched off, and it also allows the creation of a human being who is not a result of the genetic contribution of two parties, male and female, but it is 100% the genetic product of one source, whether that source be male or female, with the other thing, the other person merely being an egg donor or merely being a gestational carrier. Now, of course, that has a lot of impact on fetal development. There are hormones in pregnancy and the like, but in terms of the DNA structure will be exactly the same, basically, as the source from which the material, the DNA material, was taken. Essentially, therefore, you are creating your identical twin, who is simply many, many years younger than you, depending on how old you are at the time that there is a clone. Yeah.
Is it possible for a woman to take DNA from her and stick it into one of her eggs?
Yes. Lesbians are very much in favor of cloning because that could eliminate the need for men. Totally. Basically, absolutely. What can be done, no, I'm not thinking this is actually true. What can be done is that a woman can take DNA from her fingernail or from her hair, strip the incomplete genetic structure of the egg, right, which only has, you know, 50% of the chromosomal material, insert her own DNA into her own egg, which then undergoes an equivalent process of fertilization, although technically it's not fertilization, but the nucleus of that egg will be the DNA from any one of her cells, which may then be transferred either into the uterus of her lover, so in that way two women can produce a child, or, in an example of really just essentially self-gratification into her own body, in which she is both the genetic parent and the gestational mother, and you don't need a man. Now, it is true that human cloning does not eliminate, the male cloning does not eliminate the need for a woman. So this is an, because the idea would be that the only medium that replicates the DNA that we know is the egg. And consequently, a male clone would still need a female egg and a female uterus until we develop artificial incubators. But female cloning does not require any male input whatsoever, and it doesn't even require a female lover. It can be done totally by yourself. Yeah.
Can they make it 50 women share half and half?
Yeah, I'll discuss that. That's a mix and match cloning, which is even more disturbing. Right now, yeah, that's going to be a lot. Yes, absolutely, is absolutely possible. But right now, first I want to discuss the basic concept, which is the obtaining of DNA from a single source, which is what happened to Dolly, right? Dolly's clone was produced from Dolly's DNA. But we'll discuss the issue of what happens when it comes from more than one source, which indeed, again, this is certainly a very, very strong possibility. And we'll get into that as we discuss it. But again, in order to understand some of the ethical problems, you do at least have to have a fairly clear, although non-technical, picture of what is the innovation in cloning. Now, the thing is this. You often hear a general comment, particularly from Christian fundamentalists, that whenever there's some type of advance in genetic manipulation or genetic engineering or the like, you hear the common refrain that it's wrong to play God, that we shouldn't do these things because it is wrong to play God. There is certainly some truth to that, but on one level, I think the Jewish position is actually the opposite. The Jewish position in a general sense is that although we're not God, obviously, but to some degree we are supposed to play God, because the notion of a human being created in the image of God, right, that's in Genesis, B'Tselem Elokim, that has a lot of different meanings. That refers to intelligence. It refers to moral autonomy, freedom of choice. Okay, it refers to a lot of things. But one of the things it also refers to is the notion that human beings are supposed to be God's partner in creating the world. That God left the world in a certain state of incompletion for human beings to come along and bring holiness in the world, but not just holiness, but even scientific progress. It's interesting that, you know, we don't, as we talked about at the very beginning of this series, we never take the attitude of sickness comes from God, therefore we can't do anything about it. Rather, it's our mission in life to rectify what needs to be corrected. So the notion that one passively accepts the world as God has given it to us, and it's morally wrong for us to intervene and try to make things better for humanity, at least in the abstract, is something that Judaism rejects, because it is our goal to indeed become God's collaborative partners in making the world a better place. So consequently, to condemn a given technology because, there might be many other reasons, as we'll see, but because it's wrong to play God, is actually an incorrect assertion, because we believe that one is supposed to play God to some degree. That is indeed the notion of B'Tselem Elokim, being in the image of God, and this is the whole central, general Jewish approach to technology. Therefore, the she'ela that one asks when one is confronted with new technological advances is not to simply say, it's no good because it's new, it's no good because it interferes with nature, it's no good because it's not the normal way things are done. That's not the right question. Rather, one asks this question: given the fact that we are given a license to create new things, given the fact that we are given the power to innovate, the question is what we are doing something that has negative, evil, and wrong consequences? Or is what we are doing something that could have beneficial consequences? And the question becomes, does the good outweigh the bad, or does the bad outweigh the good? Meaning, you never have an answer, this is clearly no good, unless, of course, there are particular halachas. But in terms of general evaluation, the issue is, what are the benefits? What are the risks? Are the evils that this could open up greater than the benefits, or the benefits greater than the risks? And then a judgment would have to be made. So what I want to do is I want to do really three things. And I'm not sure I'll cover everything today. Number one is, let's try to identify legitimate uses of cloning technology and illegitimate uses. Number two, let's try to identify the ethical problems with the technology. And number three, identify specific halachic problems, which are more of a technical nature, right? So we're going to do three things. Identify good uses, bad uses. Review ethical problems. And look at technical halachic problems. Now, the technical halachic problems are primarily of concern to Orthodox Torah-believing Jews, but the general ethical problems, although they are grounded in halachic ideas, are something that are obviously going to be relevant even to non-Jews in terms of thinking about this technology. Well, let's first focus on the first aspect. What are legitimate uses versus non-legitimate? Like, why would I want a clone of myself? Isn't one of me enough, right? Somebody would say, you know, why do I have to have so many people who are the same as I? Well, one possibility would be that cloning could actually be a very useful fertility technique. Let's give a very simple example. Let's assume you have a Holocaust survivor who is the last member of his family line. When he dies and he has no kids, there will be nobody left. Let's also assume that he is infertile. Either he doesn't produce sperm, or maybe, God forbid, he's even been castrated as a result, perhaps, of Nazi experimentation. There is no way, in other words, that he can physiologically or biologically reproduce via sperm and egg. Now, adoption might be an option, certainly, and adoption might be something that we would encourage the person to consider. But once again, an adoptive child is not your genetic child, and he wants to perpetuate his line in a biological sense. Well, in the absence of sperm, under traditional reproductive technology, whether you're talking about in vitro or whatever it might be, there's nothing this fellow could do. His wife could get impregnated from an anonymous sperm bank, but as you know, halachically, there's all sorts of issues of adultery and unknown incest, and in any event, it's not going to be his biological child. But consider the possibilities that cloning opens up. You don't need sperm anymore. Any cell in your body, from any part of your body, can now supply the requisite DNA, which can then be placed into your wife's egg, from which her DNA has been stripped. The egg gets fertilized. It is transplanted to your wife. 9 months later, you have a child. Now, granted, that child is 100% from the male genetic contribution, but nevertheless, the woman has a bond via gestation, via pregnancy, etc. So it may not be 100% a child coming from the couple, but it certainly does satisfy the husband's need to have a biological child, and the woman has the emotional bond of gestation. So one might assume that cloning might be a way, in some of those unusual cases, of providing not a cure for male infertility, because it's not a cure per se, but it is an alternative route to have a biological child, right? So one might consider that to be a legitimate use of this type of technology. Yeah.
Would it be considered your brother or your son?
I'm going to talk about that. That's a very, very significant question. That's right. That's right. Yeah. I'm going to discuss that. That's a very, very important question. Well, that's right. But of course, we already have that with frozen embryos. We have that now. But this would be another example of that. Now, let me give you an example at the other extreme of a use that is clearly illegitimate and wrong. One of the uses that cloning proponents have occasionally advocated is the concept of making a spare of yourself to be available for organ donation and parts. It's like a spare parts inventory. You know, when you buy a suit, you get extra buttons, etc., or whatever it might be. So here you have a concept that you might clone yourself, which of course would give you a spare liver, a spare heart, spare kidney, all sorts of other things. And as a result, one could conceivably use the clone as a source for necessary life-saving organs. Now keep in mind that there's a certain time factor in which this is not going to work. If somebody is 65 years old and has, you know, congestive heart failure, and they start thinking about cloning at that stage in life, you know, by the time the organism or the baby or the clone is going to be big enough to have a suitable heart for transplantation, this guy's going to be dead. But we might kind of, you know, start this process at the very beginning of life to always clone. Now, most people would say, and I think Halacha would agree, that obviously to use a clone to obtain a heart, a liver, we're talking about when the clone is alive, would be simply an act of murder, and there's no particular way that that could ever be countenanced. Of course, this begs a certain question we're going to discuss. We're assuming, and I'll discuss this, that a clone is a full-fledged human being with a neshama. I will discuss why I believe that is the case. One might argue about that. Some people compare it to a golem. We'll talk about that. But if we assume that a clone has a neshama, then it is absolutely clear, and just accept that on faith for now, it is absolutely clear that to cut into the clone and take out its heart, because I need a spare heart, would be an act of murder, and that would clearly be an illegitimate use of the cloning technology. Yeah? I'll discuss that. In other words, clearly, what may be a technology of tremendous promise is the ability to generate pure liver tissue, which would not necessarily create the problems of killing an organism. But right now, when we're referring to the technology of DALI, in which you create a whole organism in an organ, that would clearly be improper. We'll talk about selective organ cloning, as it were, as we get a little on. So that's the kind of extreme. Now, by the way, there is another problem. Well, okay, we'll just say the organ donation is clearly an improper use. Now, an intermediate use, which many might say is good, is you could use a clone to obtain renewable type of resources like blood or bone marrow. Right? If you remember, I mentioned to you the case the other day of the adolescent girl who needed a bone marrow transplant, and the only compatible donor, well, there was no compatible donor. Her parents were not compatible, but her parents tried. They conceived a child together in the hope that the child would be a compatible genetic donor to the baby, to their older daughter. And lo and behold, it was really a miracle. The child was a perfect match, and the bone marrow transplant took place. And mother and the two sisters are doing fine to this day. And as I mentioned, the American press thought this was the greatest ethical dilemma, you know, since Watergate. Although abortion would have been fine, but somehow conceiving the child is a big, big shiloh. But keep in mind that that's a very uncertain type of thing. After all, neither parent was a compatible match, and there was no particular reason to assume that the sibling would necessarily be a compatible match. But lo and behold, if you could clone yourself, you would be guaranteed a genetically compatible match. And since bone marrow can be obtained even from a newborn infant and even in utero, so the time factor to wait until you have a heart or a liver, that wouldn't apply because you could obtain it almost immediately. So cloning would be a very, very satisfactory solution, one might assume, to the obtaining of things like blood and bone marrow. However, it gets very, very complicated in the following way. Oh, this is Einstein, okay. It gets very complicated because as more and more cancers are shown to be genetically based, so you see, you've got a problem. Because let's assume somebody suffers leukemia, a blood cancer. So they need a bone marrow transplant that's genetically compatible that the body is not going to reject, okay? So the one good thing about cloning, you got good news and bad news. The good thing about cloning is the body is not going to reject that bone marrow because it's genetically identical to the bone marrow in the body. But the problem is, if the bone marrow in the body has that genetic predisposition to cancer, then the new stuff, now you might be buying time, because there may be a certain time until it gets activated. And again, we really can't answer that question with certainty, because you see, even genetic predispositions to cancer depend on the risk factors. In other words, it's not simply if someone has, let's say, the colon cancer gene, as it's called, or the breast cancer gene, which many Ashkenazic women unfortunately have. That doesn't mean there's 100% certainty. Rather, there's a genetic predisposition that may be triggered if there are certain risk factors. So consequently, merely because I'm putting in the same bone marrow genetically as the from which the cancer came does not mean that that bone marrow itself will trigger the cancer, because you could then avoid the various risk factors and the like. But it is tricky. In other words, it's not a panacea. People often assume that cloning might be a procedure by which we could obtain 100% compatibility of marrow. That is true. We will obtain 100% compatibility of marrow, but the problem is you may be putting in the same problem for which you need a bone marrow transplant in the first place. Well, that might be, but even so. Oh, well, okay. In other words, but that would mean a lifetime. Well, all right. That's a possibility. Yeah, okay. That might be so. Yeah.
What's the Jewish ethics on, let's say, you're my younger brother, you're two, you can't speak, and I need a transplant from you.
Yeah.
Parents have the right to say, I'm going to take something from you, put you under a risk situation, operation, die in an operation, and take it from you anyway.
Well, that's an excellent question. We actually discussed this issue the other day, just to remind the people. No. I'll mention it very quickly again. This involved a minor boy who was the only compatible kidney donor for his older sibling. And he was willing to go ahead with the operation. His parents wanted him to go ahead with the operation. But the psak halacha was that since he was below bar mitzvah, so he was below the age of consent, his parents had no right to put him in a dangerous situation, even for the purpose of saving an older sibling. Now, if you're an adult, well, as an adult, if he would be bar mitzvah, which according to halacha is 13, he would have the right to voluntarily put himself at risk. He wouldn't be obligated. You're not obligated.
So if he's under bar mitzvah, even if he says yes and his parents say yes,
That's correct. Now, the thing is, though, the key to that is because the agreement was to put yourself in a certain dangerous situation. Having one kidney is a dangerous situation. Now, with the removal of bone marrow, I understand. In every operation, listen, I mean, people die with Novocaine on a dentist chair. That's true. But the question is, if the risk is relatively small, and it's hard to know exactly what that is, then the halacha may go in the other direction. In fact, many opinions have said that taking bone marrow from a young child does not fall into the category of a dangerous procedure. And under those circumstances, the parents could direct that marrow be taken from a baby to save an older sibling. But that is not the same as removal of a kidney or some type of thing like that. I mean, it's a question of assessing...
What does the Jewish community say when the kid dies? Those are tragedies.
Listen, there are tragedies, and life has its share of tragedies. But the question is, we have to make decisions based on what look like reasonable probabilities. Listen, when I send my five-year-old to the store, God forbid, but you still, and what happens if something happens? You say, gee, I really shouldn't have sent them to the...
It's much easier for a human being with a knife in their hand and somebody's body there to sneeze and to...
Well, you have to.
I
understand, but you have to assess the procedure. In other words, if these are procedures in which the risks are 1 out of 1,000, there are plenty of things that we send our kids out every day where the risks are higher than that. You see, in other words, you have to look at the types of risks that are considered to be normal in everyday life. You have a.
Why is it that you don't feel allowed to do something to the lightest? Yeah. Isn't there a shaila whether you're allowed to
do something? Yeah, well, in fact, it is a shaila. Yeah, in fact, it is a machlokas. This idea, can I put myself in danger to save another person?